you know, I think we've had views in this country of politics being above the gospel or being outside and irrelevant to the gospel, where I think a healthier place is for politics to be located sort of within and under our view of the gospel.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Michael Weir. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life. He's also a former White House and presidential campaign staffer, both for Barack Obama. And he's the author of the new book, The Spirit of Our Politics: Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. And that's what we're going to mostly be talking about in this conversation. And I was glad to have Michael back on the program. He first appeared in episode 22 back in 2021 to talk about his earlier book, Reclaiming Hope. Now, before we jump into this conversation, I want to remind you that if you haven't done so already, you should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness, where we deal with issues at the intersection of faith and politics like we'll be talking about in this conversation. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Michael Weir on the spirit of our politics. Well, Michael, first of all, welcome back to the show.
It's so good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to talk with you about your new book, but before we get to that, I mean, this will come out in a couple weeks after the NFL season is over, but I just, you know, wanted to check on how you're doing. I know that was mean. So I'm in Missouri. I grew up a Kansas City fan. I had to bring it up, but you know.
You know, I think I should just be grateful. You know, my childhood was, you know, after really, you know, I was cognizant, you know, as a Bills fan after the Super Bowls. We had an infamous, you know, dry spell after that. And I am honestly how amazing. I think we made the playoffs 4 of the last 5 years. And so it's a great time to be a Bills fan. But as always with being a Bills fan, there's a lot of heartbreak as well. And so much of it has come at the hands of the Kansas City Chiefs.
It has in recent years, which is also weird for me. I mean, we grew up with like always choking in the playoffs. Like it didn't matter how great they were in the season, like just like dying. And so, you know, after most of my life with Kansas City never being in the Super Bowl, because that was all before my time, it's like it's weird now, even though it's like almost become like regular. It still feels weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, I really don't have too strong feelings about the Super Bowl. And so, you know, just for the purpose of this call, I hope you win, Brian. I hope you win.
Oh, well, thanks. I thought for a moment, I thought you were going to say you're rooting for the 49ers, contentious. No.
Yeah, you guys deserve it. Really, you do.
Well, I didn't start this way just to give you a hard time. You know, your book actually starts with a Missouri reference pretty early on. And actually, not just Missouri, but someone who grew up a Southern Baptist in Missouri with Dallas Willard,
yes.
who's a key figure in your book.
Yeah,
you had me going back and look it up because, you know, you talk about Buffalo, Missouri. My mom was actually born in Buffalo, Missouri. My grandfather was a pastor there. I pastored a church near Buffalo.
Wow.
Not the church. I had to look it up. I was really curious. Not the church that Dallas grew up in, although I've been to that church. And actually, my wife's uncle was a pastor of that church at one time.
Wow.
So anyways, yeah, I kind of got distracted, you know, in the introduction to go like, wait, I didn't realize that Dallas was from Buffalo.
Yeah. There's a place that I don't think I put this in the book, but there's a like a little like saloon. I've never been, but like this saloon bar restaurant thing that called the Lamplighter. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Lamplighter, but I've always wanted to make a pilgrimage because I just heard that this was a place, and I kind of like the
you know, the lamplighter has sort of, you know, spiritual overtones. And so I just always imagine this, you know, the most holy saloon in the country, the lamplighter, but yeah, no, that's a lot of fun history.
Yeah. So if you, when you make your pilgrimage to Buffalo, Missouri, let me know. I'm only about less than two hours away. So
great.
Let's start there, because, you know, Dallas is important in helping shape and frame your book, The Spirit of Our Politics. So let's start first with, who is Dallas Willard, for those that, you know, are familiar, or maybe they know the name and they're trying to remember, like, wait, I know who he is and I'm trying to remember why.
Yeah, great. So Dallas Willard passed about a decade ago. He was a philosopher. He taught at the University of Southern California for decades. For a time, he was chair of the philosophy department at USC. He was a he specialized in the philosopher in Husserl. That was his one of his primary areas of focus. So he had this career in sort of secular academia. He also was a teacher and author of many Christian books, including The Divine Conspiracy, Spirit of the Disciplines, Renovation of the Heart. You know, I think his work has obviously been profoundly impactful in my life. I was sent a copy of The Divine Conspiracy in my first few months working in the White House. And when I finally picked it up and read it, it was like a second spiritual awakening in my life. And he's influenced the way I think about God, scripture, my own life. My wife and I have made all kinds of personal decisions that after reading or listening to one of his books, and his outlook has tremendously impacted me. This book, The Spirit of Our Politics, is largely an application of Willard's ideas to politics and public life, which I think will be surprising for folks who are familiar with Willard, and I think have in a way that's unjustified and a bit removed from the material itself, placed Willard and really the spiritual formation sort of movement in the category of like what you do when you have time to go on personal retreat, or hopefully one of the things I want this, I hope this book will do is give fresh eyes to spiritual formation as something that is for all of life, and perhaps especially not for the quiet times, but spiritual formation is especially for when you're in the very thick of life, at the very moment of crisis. And so Willard has just been, and you know, I don't hide the ball here. It's very apparent reading the book that this is not just sort of like loosely inspired by. It is my attempt to bring Willard into direct conversation with politics and public life in an extended way.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to start our conversation there, because it's really important for understanding what you're arguing. Before we get into that a little bit more, let's maybe take a step back though and look at our current politics, because you're reading Dallas and you're thinking, all right, what could Christian politics be like?
Yeah.
But that's because it's not right now. Right. And so, I mean, you start the book, perhaps the like least controversial or shocking statement, our politics is sick.
Yeah.
Breaking news alert there. But then you talk about, though, the sickness is actually perhaps worse, or at least different than we often think about it. And here's the metaphor that you have it there at the beginning. You wrote, "Our politics is suffering not from appendicitis, but from leukemia. The problem is not that something has gone wrong, but that the very logic on which the entire system operates exasperates the sickness. We don't need an appendectomy. We need new marrow in our bones." Let's unpack that metaphor, because I think that's really important in thinking about understanding what's the problem of our politics before we start thinking about how do we fix it.
Yeah. So I think that there is a tendency for many reasons in our politics to to think, oh, if we just elect this candidate, oh, if we just had campaign finance reform, you know, if we just had these structural sort of changes, then our politics would be not just healthier. I do think that there are some that there, like, yes, you could iteratively have some improvement in our politics by having stronger voting rights protection laws, campaign finance reform. But this idea that we could sort of technique our way out of our political dysfunction, that, oh, you know, if we just changed the people around, had some different policies, we our politics would be fine. What I argue in the book is actually the way things are in our politics are not detached from the kind of people we are, not detached from the incentives that voters give to our politics. It actually has much to do with it. The kind of politics we have has much to do with the kind of people we are. That is a different way, I think, particularly at the individual level, of thinking about the personal responsibility and role that we have in participating in our political life. I think the easiest thing to do, not just for voters, but for politicians, is to say, the problem is out there. You know, look at those bums in Washington or at the state capitol. The more difficult thing to do is to say, no, actually, the state of our politics is a reflection of the state of our souls. Not perfectly. It's not a perfect reflection. That's why democratic reform is important. We don't have a perfect one-to-one sort of reflection of the will of the people in our politics. And we could have a philosophical debate about whether that would even be a great thing. But this book is very much focused on at the personal and individual level, and the way that that impacts then how we organize as communities and how that filters up to our politics.
Yeah, and I think that's really helpful in us thinking about, here we find ourselves in an election year, which obviously you knew when you're writing, you're thinking about this book, you knew that it was going to drop most likely in an election cycle. And, you know, it can be really easy just to focus on, let's elect the right people, let's support the right party, let's support the right candidates, and then everything will work out fine. And as if it's only the other side, they're the reason our politics is broken. And we find that, literally, even when we elect pastors into office, like, our politics hasn't changed.
Yeah. Yes. There is a framework for talking about and for looking at the kind of polarization we have today that I talk about in the book and is really a through line through the whole book. It was released by a number of really well-respected social scientists in 2020. They said that the particular kind of polarization we have today, they called it political sectarianism. Political sectarianism is, in their words, a toxic cocktail made up of three key ingredients. First, the tendency of aversion, which is the tendency to dislike or distrust opposing partisans. The tendency of othering, the tendency to other those who are politically different. And then the tendency of moralization, or a misplaced moralization, which elevates political disagreement or even the assumption of political disagreement to a matter of good versus evil, to a level really of sin or iniquity. And they write, and I think that there's been social science that's come out in the last three, four years since this framework was released, that I think has backed their assertion, which is that political sectarianism has both profound links to government dysfunction and the way our politics is operating. It also profoundly impacts communities, families, churches. Our political culture is affecting and contributing to greater cultural dysfunction and relational and social dysfunction in a way that is hard to ignore now. Like, that's always been the case, right? Like, politics never stayed contained to politics. It's becoming more and more apparent, I think, especially to pastors, how the idea of keeping politics outside of the four walls of the church, whatever you think about that in sort of as a principle or as an ideal, it's an impracticality in a culture as soaked in politics as ours is.
Yeah, I think, and I hear that from pastors all the time. And then they were feeling that pre-COVID, but then COVID particularly exasperated the sense of every decision was political. And in election years, I know this happened in 2020. I know it's going to happen again this year. Pastors are going to have people come up to them and they're going to be trying to read into, you know, comments in a sermon as to, oh, I think this means he was supporting this candidate. And the pastor's like, that wasn't even on my mind.
Right. Yeah, that was like the reading of the, like, that was given to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
I was just reading the lectionary text. Yeah. Maybe the Spirit was working on you in a certain way, but
that's right. Yeah. But it's a real problem. And I introduced this concept of political therapeutic deism in the book, which of course is riffing off of moral therapeutic deism. Which is a term developed by Christian Smith and Melissa Lundquist. I don't have the dates in front of me. I think it was 2004, 2005. And moral therapeutic deism came out of interviews that Smith and Lundquist were doing with teenagers. And they wrote a book about sort of the moral life of teenagers of that generation. And it basically refers to a vague set of quasi-religious beliefs that basically exist to affirm the goodness of the person. That's the moral part. What I argue in the book is that we've seen a political therapeutic deism emerge instead of, or in it, you know, in the 90s, there was a seeker sensitive church movement. I think we have a politics sensitive church movement now where pastors either responsively or to try to take advantage of some dynamics they see developing, churches are making decisions to play to or play around the political affections and affinities of people. That is a dangerous thing. The kinds of beliefs associated with political therapeutic deism include things like I am sure that God supports my political party. I can be certain what policy issues are most important to God. And these sorts of beliefs leverage religion to support one's political views, as opposed to placing one's political views in a way where they are influenced by the teachings of your faith. I talk about, I think we've had views in this country of politics being above the gospel or being outside and irrelevant to the gospel, where I think a healthier place is for politics to be located sort of within and under our view of the gospel. But there are some profound sort of forces and intuitions that are very much working against that these days.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously that viewpoint is so dangerous to our politics. It's part of the sickness. I mean, this idea that when people talk about, you know, talking about political issues, we'll talk about it as spiritual warfare. And, you know, the other side is our demons.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got to put on the armor of God, you know, going into politics. And, you know, I mean, that's destructive because you don't compromise with demons. You don't work with them.
Yes.
And so, I mean, we're in a very dangerous place politically, and unfortunately, Christian language and theology is being used to make our politics worse, oftentimes.
Yes. I mean, clearly that is happening. So the first chapter of my book is talking about the state of our politics. The second is about this idea of the disappearance of moral knowledge. This is a concept Willard articulated. His arguably his primary academic work is on this subject. And the basic argument here is that in the post-World War II era, gatekeepers of knowledge, essentially academia, but also others, acted as if and acted on the idea that moral and religious knowledge should not be counted as publicly available, teachable knowledge. At best, moral and religious knowledge is something that is personally useful, but it's not publicly accessible. This way of thinking about the problem, I think, complicates some of the narratives we have today. Clearly, there are people who identify as religious who are making some really and Christianity specifically, some really negative contributions to our public life. I think we need to be careful not to suggest that with all of their bloviation and all of their bluster, their problem is not that they hold too closely to the faith. their problem is not that they just need to believe in the Bible like less. No, the problem is not that they're too Christian. It's that they're not Christian enough. The problem is that what underlies all of this bluster is actually a profound insecurity, not confidence. And so that needs to be addressed. I think there's a lot of good work. I really appreciate the work of this academic Tobias Kremer, who I think has done a wonderful job of helping and a nuanced job of helping us understand how not just in America, but globally, religious symbols, rhetoric, even institutions can be leveraged and misused to support anti-democratic, illiberal, extreme sort of political causes. What I want to stay away from, not just because I hope it's not the case. I actually don't think it's the case. And I don't think it's helpful if we allow the worst actors in our politics to claim the mantle of Christian. It reminds me, Brian, just one sort of additional thought on this. It reminds me of in the post 9/11 period, you had a lot of like well-meaning sort of commentators who sort of were in their mind, I think, positioning themselves as sort of like generous, moderate sort of voices. And you had all of these calls for, I'm not opposed to Islam. What we really need is a moderate Islam. You know, where are all the moderate sort of Muslims speaking up that aren't so devoted, who understand we live in a cosmopolitan world and sort of all. And I remember I was in a meeting and someone was issuing like these kinds of calls, and a Muslim participant in the meeting stood up and said, I just want to say I understand the sentiment, but it often I would like you to consider that this is these calls sometimes come across as if I were to stand up in this meeting and to call for lukewarm Christians. You know, what we really need are some lukewarm Christians to sort of balance out the ones who are really committed. And he goes, no one wants to be a lukewarm. No Christian wants to be a lukewarm Christian. And no Muslim wants to suggest that they are less committed to the faith than these others. No, what we need is a healthy conception of
of Islam, which, you know, this imam said, like, let me be clear, like, they're not the ones with it. You know, I'm not going to see that. So I think we're in a similar moment now where I think people are rightly, people are in a similar moment in this way. I think people are rightly reacting against the misuse of religion to affirm really awful sort of political actions and behavior. We need to oppose that while also not ceding the conversation about Christianity itself to those worst actors.
No, I think that's so well put. I mean, this idea of the problem not being that they're being too Christian in their politics, but that they're not being Christian enough or faithful enough. That's what resonates so well in your book. Because, I mean, you're not calling for Christians to step out of the public square, or you're not calling for Christians to not bring their faith into the public square. What you're trying to argue is that a Christian politics, it looks different than what it currently often seems to mean and to be. And this is where you're drawing really heavily on Dallas Willard, of course, into understanding, like, what does it mean to live out kingdom values, not just in a private spiritual retreat, but in public life. So let's talk a little bit about, like, what does Christian politics look like?
Yeah. So I think for too long in this country, when we've had conversations about, you know, what does Christianity have to offer our politics, our primary way of wrestling with that question is to debate sort of, what does Christianity say definitively on this issue or that issue? And I do think that Christianity offers resources for thinking about the most pressing, challenging policy questions. I think that's true, and there's application work to be done in that way. I think in this moment, the greatest contribution that Christianity has to offer to our politics is not telling our politics what it is, but reminding our politics what it isn't. And so I talk in the book about politics is not ultimate, it's penultimate. It's not dogmatic, it's prudential. It is not, as C.S. Lewis writes in Mere Christianity, you know, scripture doesn't offer a particular political program. It's to be applied by people in their time, in their circumstances. So there's a contingency to politics. The vote is not a pure, unmediated expression of your will and identity. It is contingent. It is prudential. And so these kinds of, and this is Christian knowledge. Christianity isn't the only way you can get to this understanding. I think that there's a lot of evidence that politics is prudential outside of Christianity, but this is Christian knowledge about the nature of politics and how we ought to relate to it that everyone needs right now. That would be a great blessing to our politics, precisely and in part because it undermines those three ingredients of political sectarianism. It undermines the tendency of aversion and othering and a misplaced moralization. And so that's part of it. Again, I'm not trying to exclude attempts to allow Christian resources, theology, history, institutional knowledge, the resources of Christian people of informing our policy preferences. But first, we need to understand the nature of politics, what it is, and then again, importantly, what it is not. And Christianity has great resources to offer there as well. And if we reaffirm those things, again, it would greatly help our politics. It would also profoundly help our churches and pastors who will then have a context from which their people, those in the pews, are thinking about politics
that places it again in the flow of the life of the church, not as this thing that is above or outside of it.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation, but first I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
You know, this is what I think is really significant. You reference it a lot of times. We think about, well, so what does the Bible say about this issue? And that's often what our books about Christian politics are, right? It's like a guidebook of, all right, this issue, some Bible verses and some commentary, this issue, right? It's policy oriented. And you're wanting us to think more about how we behave.
Yeah.
And right, so particularly, I mean, we can think about like the fruits of the Spirit maybe more broadly, but particularly you zone in on gentleness.
Yeah.
Which is the first word I always think of when I think of politics, right?
Yeah.
So give us your, I mean, give us the short pitch. You'll have to read the book to get the long pitch, but what's your short pitch for Christian gentleness in politics?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first I'd say this idea that we have another option is so telling about how we think about politics, which is like politics is this area where like you go to get things done, like according to the rules of politics, whatever people take those to be, so that maybe you could be Christian in other areas of your life. But gentleness is a fruit of the Spirit. Like, so there is no political you. You're just you. And if you are not gentle in politics, if when you are interacting with politics, you bully people, you lie, you manipulate, that is not separate from the real you. Like, it's not just, oh, that's just like when I'm in politics, but you should get to know me in real life. No, that's you. And so very quickly, this gets to questions of spiritual formation of the kind of person you are in a way that is less neatly cut off from our interaction with politics than we often, I think and operate as though it is. And so that would be sort of the first thing to say. And it's, I don't say this as a judgmental, it's just really helpful. If we think that gentleness is not viable in politics, we need to ask ourselves why that is. And we need to ask ourselves where else in our lives, if gentleness is not viable in politics, where else may we not think that gentleness is viable? How much of our lives is a logic that suggests it's not safe to follow Jesus's way? How much of our lives is that logic overtaken our hearts and our thoughts and our ideas? So that would be the first thing. Second thing I'd say is I talk about this term in the book, political hobbyist, which it was developed by this political scientist at Tufts, Eitan Hersh. And a political hobbyist, just like quickly, and I write more about it in the book, but just to, is basically someone who is consumed with thoughts about politics and is the kind of person who's sort of getting in political arguments online all of the time and consuming a lot of like political entertainment. And if you ask them, they'd say, oh, like I'm burnt out from politics. The problem is that they, for all of their thought life that is consumed with sort of political notions, they actually never actually do politics. So that none of this energy that they're expending is actually about building power for self-governance. And so that's an so often when people say, like, gentleness doesn't work in politics, or how could I even think about being gentle in politics? There's one conversation I need to have on that. So I'm going, I'm going to be talking with Hill staffers on exactly this. And they have very specific questions that they have vocational questions that do make this more complicated, which is like my boss is asking me to put out a press statement that is not gentle. Like, what do I do? But for the average person, I just find it fascinating the kinds of responsibilities we take on that are not our own for as like make believe political strategists or like activists. Like, so all of that is to say, Brian, I would ask people in their lives to think, like, what is actually preventing you from being gentle in politics? Like, what do you think you personally have to achieve in your political involvement that gentleness precludes? And just thinking about that question will solve, or at least start to solve so much of this, so much of this disbelief that gentleness is viable in politics. The last thing I say, this chapter in my book, I talk about a number of beliefs that that work, that we hold, that sort of add up to this objection to gentleness in politics. And they include beliefs like we need anger, we need fear. I unpack those in pretty extensive ways, especially this idea of anger in our politics, which is something we really need to wrestle with. We overvalue anger significantly, and so there's so much more to say here. But this chapter is such, I think, a pivotal chapter because it goes right to the heart of it. It's one thing to say, yes, let's embrace Christian values. Like, we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't march through Lafayette Square and hold up the Bible in front of St. John's Church as tear gas is being, you know, like those are easy. I take this into your own life. I need to take this into my own life and ask what is keeping me from thinking that gentleness is viable in our politics.
That was such a weird hypothetical example about tear gassing people and holding up a Bible. I don't know where you even think of things like that.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I have a creative imagination, Brian.
That's it. But, yeah. I mean, maybe so. But right, when you were in the Obama administration, your imagination never pictured a scene like that.
No, I mean, what's funny, Brian, is my office was on Lafayette Square. And when people would ask me, what was it like working at the White House? My line has always been, and genuinely, it was like working on Sesame Street. Because if you've ever walked, I mean, it's just a beautiful place. And I like can't say that anymore because the predominant sort of picture in my mind of Lafayette Square is no longer like this place. It's like beautifully lit up with like these row houses at Christmas time. But yeah, that's an aside, but yeah, it wasn't Sesame Street, during the previous administration. Yeah.
Sesame Street has been tear gassed. That's the metaphor for our politics today.
Oh yeah. 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 There's a TikTok video in there somewhere of, that would really drive the point home, Brian.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to cover one more thing in the book, because one of the things that you also do, as if gentleness wasn't a big enough of a kind of a stretch for us all to think about politics, you also like talk about spiritual disciplines as a way of thinking about politics. And I mean, obviously you have several more, we won't cover them all, and we all want to give people a reason to buy the book anyways, can't give it all away for free. But I wonder if you'd pick maybe like a spiritual discipline and help us think about what does it mean to view politics, to engage in politics with the insights that we gain from the spiritual disciplines.
Yeah. So let me just sort of step back and just say, one of my primary hopes for this book is that it provides Christians with a way of talking about and thinking about and participating in politics with resources that do not come from the toxic logic of our politics itself. Dallas Willard has a model for spiritual formation that I would argue informed the way he wrote all of his books. But he unpacks this model in his book, Renovation of the Heart, and it's VIM, vision, intention, means. He said, whether it's Christian spiritual formation or not, spiritual formation is defined by this flow of vision, intention, and means. And so my book is written with this in mind, vision, intention, means. Spiritual practices and disciplines are not a checklist of things that you do to be a super Christian or to earn God's favor. Spiritual disciplines are ways learned from the life of Jesus and those who have followed Jesus of indirect means to what the scriptures refer to as taking off the old self with its practices and putting on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge of the image of its creator. Spiritual practices are means by which we participate with God in doing this. And so if the kind of people we are has much to do with the kind of politics we have, we can actually participate with God in becoming a different kind of people. And disciplines are one of the ways in which we do that. And so, as you said, this book is meant to be very practical. There's some philosophical work that has to be done to sort of justify it. But this book gets very practical. And in this chapter on spiritual disciplines, I offer a range of practices, both old, tried, and true, and then what I call sort of 21st century disciplines for our public life. They include things like celebration, worship, study, prayer. I think silence and solitude are essential disciplines for this age and moment we're in particular, in which we are just bombarded in a way that's unprecedented in human history, bombarded with messages, arguments, advertisements, all of these communications vying for our attentions and our affections. Silence and solitude are ways in which we are reminded that we are more than the sum, the amalgamation of all these various inputs, that we have a soul. And so I talk about silence and solitude. And then I also offer these disciplines as a sort of contradiction to some of the negative impulses of our politics. So, for instance, to contradict moralization, I offer confession as a discipline. I offer service and fellowship as disciplines that counter aversion and othering. And so I'm hopeful that chapter will help to answer the question of like, what do I do now? Okay, like I'm sold. Politics is not just about having, not just politics. Politics is not just about having the right positions. And the Christian faith is about about much more than just having the right answers. So like, what do I do? How do I make a healthier contribution to our politics? How do I actually grow in the likeness of Jesus if it's not just about repeating lines of dogma over and over again? Like if there's more to walking with Jesus than just repeating back justified by faith, you know, or like these core important lines of doctrine. But if there's more to it, like what's next? How do I live with Jesus now, in interactive relationship with him? And practices are one way to do that.
So as we close, shifting gears away from your book, because the only thing you're doing in life is not writing books. And so I wanted to give you a chance to talk about what you're doing some of the rest of your time. You're the founding president and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life. So why don't you tell us what that is and what you all do?
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Brian. So the Center for Christianity and Public Life,
publicly launched in 2022, we have the mission to contend for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. And we advance that work through Christian civic formation or spiritual formation and public imagination. We run an annual summit. We run a public life fellowship program. We run a community of young professionals that are in civic life. And this book is an expression out of our public imagination work. It's also the spirit of our politics is a great way to understand why we go about our work as an organization the way that we do. And so the book is in some ways an introduction to our model of Christian political engagement and thought. And so yeah, we're in the thick of our second year. Now folks can learn about the Center for Christianity and Public Life at ccpubliclife.org, and would love to have folks engaged in and supporting our work.
Okay. Well, we'll also put links at on our show notes at dogma.wordandway.org, as well as links to your new book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. Michael, thanks so much for joining us on the show and for all the work that you're doing.
Hey, thanks. If I could just mention one more thing, which is if you go to our website, ccpubliclife.org/book, we have created a discussion guide for small groups of friends, book clubs to walk through the spirit of our politics. That's a free guide, and folks can sign up and they'll receive it immediately at ccpubliclife.org/book. And so hopefully that's a helpful resource. But Brian, so grateful for the work you do, and thanks for this conversation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.